When we were in psychiatric units, we, the patients, were the biggest support to each other. We helped each other out as the nurses sat behind the glass bubble. For many of us doing this work of sharing our lived and learned experiences, that's where it started. Peer support for this talk. I define peer support as individuals with lived experience of something providing support to others with similar lived experiences. Let's keep it at its simplest, purest form. This is nothing new. It has been happening informally throughout history. When we introduced this topic in presentations and trainings describing peer support, we often share the example of new parents who seek or are given support and guidance by more experienced parents to address daily childcare questions or concerns. I'm a mom of an 8-year-old. I am 52 years old. I had no idea how to take care of my daughter. I immediately turned to other moms, dads, or parents. I needed their support, expertise. I think you get where I'm going, and I hope we can agree that providing support and learning from others with similar lived experience is natural. It's understood, and it can be life-sustaining. What is new in the United States since the late 1980s is the hiring of people with lived experiences of mental illness, former patients and ex-patients and survivors as peer supporters in the mental health field to provide support to people with mental illnesses in formal, traditional mental health outpatient and inpatient facilities. My talk today will discuss some of the ways in which the development and professionalization of peer support in the United States has been revolutionary, and ways in which for some it has been harmful, and to address ways in which we can learn how to more effectively address some of the challenges to implementation of paid peer support. Before I begin, it is important to me as a womanist to state my positionality and my intersectional identities, which influence my understanding of this work based on my shared lived and learned experiences, but also my privileges as an educator and academic from the top universities in the United States. I am Black, queer, woman, survivor, professor, mother, storyteller, poet. I've occupied labels of mental illness, anxiety, depression, bipolar, addict, traumatized, PTSD. I've been abused, assaulted, hospitalized, medicated, treated, mistreated, survivor. I am trained academically in the disciplines of social psychology and social work. I'm trained practically as a community organizer and social worker. Important to my work is co-production, co-design, participatory approaches to research and program development. My research overall is on sociocultural pathways to recovery and healing. I believe, and we have demonstrated, that peer support is one of those ways. I started in the support space many years ago as a volunteer, providing support to others from my community who were at the time thought to be dying from HIV and AIDS. I did not have HIV, but I had similar lived experiences as many of the women. The women were paid to provide education, support, and to manage the warm line, a telephone connection to address questions about HIV. Little did I know that peer support was happening in the mental health system and being studied under direction of my now current boss, Dr. Larry Davidson. As many of you may know, my colleagues at Yale's Program for Recovery and Community Health, PERCH, have been at the forefront of the development and evaluation of mental health peer support since the early 1990s. The focus of today's talk is on peer support in the mental health and behavioral health field. In the United States, Medicare and Medicaid services have added peer support to its menu of evidence-based and reimbursable services, and peer health navigators are a key part of the person-centered behavioral health home model, which is a coordinated healthcare approach to address mental and physical wellness through better coordination of services. Most states in the United States have some, and some internationally, have developed a peer support certification process to incorporate this relatively new and promising approach. So what do peer supporters do in practice? At the root of peer support is the peer supporter's ability to connect and develop relationships with other individuals in recovery. The connection is often established because of the feeling of commonality. We are in this together. That often comes from having had similar lived experiences. It's a feeling of, this person gets me. Peer supporters are also taught to enhance their relational skills. Intentional peer support, developed by colleague Sherry Mead initially and is now known internationally, is one mechanism that is currently being used with a focus on relational skills. In the United States, Mental Health America developed a national accredited certification for peer support. There is a debate among those that have been involved in developing peer support whether national certification is the way to go. Training peer supporters. In 2001, the state of Georgia became the first state to fund peer support as a Medicaid fundable service. And on December 1st, 2001, 35 mental health consumers had an opportunity to participate in a training and exam to become Georgia's first class of certified peer specialists, which allowed them to bill for Medicaid services. Since 2001, Georgia's program has trained thousands. As peer support became Medicaid fundable in many states across the country, there has been a proliferation of state peer certification training programs. Connecticut and a few other United States do not directly receive Medicaid funding. Through data compiled by the Texas Institute for Excellence in Mental Health at the University of Texas at Austin, as of July 2016, 41 states and the District of Columbia had established peer certification training programs, and two states were in the process of developing certification programs. Training programs vary in length and content, with most occurring over 4 to 10 days. Topics taught generally include concepts of hope and recovery, interpersonal communication, telling your recovery story, identification, and treatment of mental health disorders, wellness management, legal issues in mental health, stigma and discrimination issues in mental health, boundary issues, ethics, confidentiality, cultural competence and linguistic issues, overview of evidence-based practices, and workplace considerations. Modalities used to train peer supporters range from generally include lectures, discussions, role plays, and group exercises. Following training, most states administer an examination, written and or oral, before certifying individuals. Criteria for eligibility to become peer supporters varies across states. Most states require that applicants first and foremost identify as a person with a psychiatric or addiction history, and then vary when it comes to other requirements. Some have a minimum age requirement. Others expect applicants to be out of the hospital for a defined period of time. We do not advocate this requirement. While others want applicants to have a high school diploma. In addition, most states, supervisors of peer supporters are not people trained to provide peer support. And unfortunately, many are not experienced in the art of disclosure of lived experience, personally or professionally. Partnering with peer supporters in the workplace. The hiring and retaining of peer supporters has been met with a few challenges, such as lack of role clarity, what is it that peer supporters will do, readiness to promote recovery-oriented care within the organization, lack of preparation for supervisors of those in peer support roles, salary equity remains an issue, and unclear pathways for promotion and towards developing a recognized, worthy discipline. Part of these challenges to the recognition and inclusion of peer supporters in the behavioral and mental health field stems from beliefs about recovery. It has only been a short time since people received messages from the behavioral health field, particularly related to mental illness, that recovery was not possible. To go from a system that believed this to one that now embraces people with lived experiences working in the mental health field is still a far leap for some providers who have yet to embrace that people with lived experiences have a unique set of skills to add to the work of others on clinical teams. We are currently working on an approach to develop learning collaboratives for agencies that are interested in partnering with peer supporters in the workforce. The goal of this initiative is to help agencies establish the organizational culture and administrative infrastructure, as well as to provide education on role clarity and supervision of peer supporters. Some of the challenges that peer supporters have faced in the workforce include lack of role clarity, transition into employment, lack of a career ladder as a peer supporter, as I said before, equitable pay services, lack of effective supervision, microaggressions in the workplace by non-peer staff, co-optation. Based on our experiences, we recommend that agencies plan for how to address these challenges rather than simply hiring peer supporters. Microaggressions. I led a meeting a few years ago and was doing a discussion on microaggressions in the workplace for peer supporters. One of the peer supporters, who was a Black woman, came back to the agency and told her supervisor of the microaggressions that she has faced as a peer supporter in the agency. The supervisor wrote in the peer supporter's employment records that the peer came back from a conference having learned a new word to use against them. The peer supporter called to tell me, "My heart sunk." Microaggressions, for those that are not familiar with the term, are defined as subtle blows delivered incessantly, resulting in small wounds. They result when members of privileged groups, however they might be defined in any one instance, exert their power over the less privileged. Microaggressions related to mental illness and addictions are brief and commonplace daily verbal and behavioral indignities, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative slights and insults, and potentially have a harmful or unpleasant psychological impact on the target person or group. Microaggressions refer to the things you experience every day that then add up and take their toll. Microaggressions lead to further internalization of stigma because of the saliency of the externalized aggression. Implicit and explicit messages related to mental illness include: he or she is different, dangerous, a nutcase, a ticking time bomb, a chronic schizophrenic or a dual diagnosis, a junkie, a bum. We know from the work of scholar Dr. Sue, who studied microaggressions on racial and ethnic minorities, that racial microaggressions create a hostile and invalidating climate for people of color, saps their spiritual and psychic energies, and their cumulative nature can result in depression, frustration, anger, rage, loss of self-esteem, anxiety, etc. My colleagues and I recently conducted a study on microaggressions among peer supporters. It was published in the journal Psychological Services in 2019. This was one of the first attempts at studying microaggressions among this population. We wanted to know, one, are peer supporters experiencing microaggressions in the workplace? Two, what kinds of experiences are they having on the job? Three, What ways, if any, do participants say these experiences influence them? For example, their own mental health, their job performance? And four, how do they cope with these experiences? We conducted an online survey of open-ended questions. 65 participants answered the survey. Data were coded using directed content analysis. Participants across a wide range of facilities and geographic locations reported experiencing microaggressions in the workplace. The content of microaggressions fell into two domains. The first, negative messages about the nature of having a mental illness and disclosing this information to others. And the second, negative messages about the role of peer support specialists. So for negative messages about mental illness and disclosure, in the study, participants described experiencing overt stigma. The message that they need to keep their personal experiences with mental illness private, and that the experience of being defined by their diagnosis only. Examples of overt stigma spanned hearing clinicians joke about recovery-oriented language, people making jokes about me being a patient, and included being the specific target of negative messages about mental illnesses, such as a person said, "When I heard others say that by hiring peers, they were letting the patients run the asylum." Participants described experiences in which other members of the team invalidated their role on the team and questioned their integrity as people because of their identity as a peer, such as, one said, "The doctor on the unit told other staff not to trust me or listen to me because I am just a patient." Peers' responses to microaggressions included feeling isolated, seeking social support, employing coping strategies, and demonstrating resiliency and increased motivation to do peer work. Some peer supporters reported leaving positions due to these experiences. Our findings indicate that microaggressions are common experiences for peer supporters that can have detrimental impact on their sense of self and role in the mental health field. The negative stereotypes inside and outside mental health services, the labeling of people as treatment resistant and non-compliant, and the sensational media stories carry rhetoric messages, creating barriers towards participation and collaborative practices. Co-optation. My colleagues here in the United States, such as Darby Penny, who has written about these issues for Mad in America, have offered that a resulting factor, and not a good one, is co-optation. Co-optation, as defined by the Oxford Dictionary, is the process by which a group subsumes or assimilates a smaller or weaker group with related interests, or similarly, the process by which one group converts from another group by attempting to replicate the aspects that they find appealing without adopting the full program or ideals. At the root of co-optation is power and privilege. Some have said the term peer support itself has been co-opted. That's by Sarah Davidoff and Mad in America. So what does co-optation mean? Sellout. One who betrays a cause for a personal advantage. Culture vulture. One who steals traits, language, or fashion from another culture. However, co-optation and peer support means peer support staff lose connection with values and take on views and beliefs that demean people who use services. The organization doesn't support peer support staff's role through policy and practice. Peer supporters may feel pressure as not to appear as one of those. What might it feel like? Peers doing work of others in the organization that might prescribe to a distinct set of values. Peers feeling that the work itself compromises their peer or recovery values. Conclusion. In conclusion, we have talked about a lot today. What can be done? One, know the history of the consumer, survivors, ex-patients, mad people's self-help movement. Nothing about us without us. If organizations do not have peer support values and ethics for practice, develop peer support values and ethics, get a sense of how they might get played out in a working relationship. It's very important. Two, role clarity and work responsibilities. Job descriptions are important. However, role clarity relates to all on the team having a sense of their roles on the team and that of others. Number three, policies and procedures must consider the role of peer supporters. They were not developed for peer supporters, but for traditional clinical services. Let's take a serious look at ways in which we can decrease or eliminate microaggressions or the chances of co-optation consuming the process. There is much work that needs to be done to further advance the practice and research of peer support. But like with any new or enhanced innovation, we must work with the community of people with lived expertise, organizations, and clinical providers to plan more effectively how to partner with peer supporters so they can effectively deliver peer support services.